Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this week, Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call joined another lawsuit against President Trump's administration.
Call joins 19 other attorneys general in a lawsuit challenging cuts to National Health and Human Services programs.
In the lawsuit, Call says that the HHS cuts, quote, threaten Wisconsin efforts to remove lead in Milwaukee schools, reduce maternal deaths, and prevent youth tobacco use.
And just this morning, the Attorney General's office announced the state is joining another lawsuit, this one over cuts to congressionally approved federal funding for electric vehicle infrastructure. Attorney General Josh Call is here to explain Wisconsin's position in those and other lawsuits. Attorney General Call, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this HHS funding cut lawsuit. You joined this, you announced this on Tuesday. Can you explain your position here, why Wisconsin is involved in this?
Yeah, well, this is now the fourth suit that we have specifically relating to actions by the Department of Health and Human Services. And what's going on at that department is deeply concerning to me. We've seen a mix of conspiracy theories and this approach from DOGE of just recklessly slashing programs. And one of the places that that's really playing out is in the HHS program specifically. The plan that Secretary Kennedy has is to slash about 20,000 employees from that department. He has shut down or is in the process of shutting down some regional offices. And critical services that HHS provides are either being stopped or being dramatically reduced. One example is SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They do really important work relating to mental health and substance use disorder. But he's trying to slash the number of employees there in half. And we've alleged that because of what they're doing, they're not going to be able to fulfill a number of statutory mandates that they have. So this is causing harms to states. It's causing harms to the public. And we've gone to court to stop this from moving forward.
And that's a key part of this and other suits, whatever you might think of these decisions as policy decisions. You and other attorneys general are making the case that this violates federal laws in a way that do harm here in Wisconsin. Can you spell that out a little more?
That's right. You know, there are two things that I consider when I decide whether to get Wisconsin involved in a multi-state suit like this. One is there a policy that is harmful to Wisconsinites? And as I talked about here, that's part of what's going on. But secondly, do we have a strong legal basis for bringing a suit? It doesn't serve any purpose for us to file a suit if I don't like a policy, but we don't have a good legal basis for challenging it. But here we've argued that there are numerous laws that the Department of Health and Human Services is not going to be complying with as a result of its actions. And that's something we've really seen throughout these lawsuits is not just the Trump administration making bad policy decisions, but really flouting the laws and ignoring them, treating acts of Congress that were passed by Congress and signed into law by a president, not as something that they are required to uphold, but as something they can ignore. And that's part of the reason we've had some of the success we have. And it's the basis for a number of the suits we've been filing as well.
That number, I believe, has grown to 15 by my count with the announcement this morning of another lawsuit, this one over electric vehicle infrastructure. Our reporters have talked about what this could mean for plans to boost that infrastructure here in Wisconsin. Talk us through this lawsuit.
Well, this is a good example of the point we were just talking about. So as part of the bipartisan infrastructure law, Congress set up a program to fund electric vehicle infrastructure around the country. There are funds going to states across the U.S. And here in Wisconsin, we are in line to receive over $60 million funds to support electric vehicle infrastructure. And whether or not President Trump agrees with that policy, it's the law of the land. And despite that, his administration has said that they're not going to award the funds that were passed into law by Congress and signed into law by President Biden. And that's just not how our system of government works. The president's job is to faithfully execute the laws. And what we have Donald Trump here doing instead is disregarding those laws and attempting to, by fiat, essentially ignore them. And that is just not how our system of government works. We have a constitutional republic, and he's ignoring that. Now, this also has bad policy effects because it would undermine our efforts to address climate change. And it's going to mean that jobs that would go would be created to create this infrastructure won't be able to move forward. People won't be able to get hired because these funds are being stalled. So we've gone to court to seek the release of these funds. And because this is part of a statute that was signed into law, I'm very confident that we're going to be successful in this case.
Checking in on another ongoing suit now that you joined in, cuts to the Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Minority Business Development Agency, and the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. You challenged those cuts this week. A preliminary injunction issued. That isn't the end of the story, of course. These things get resolved and appealed in different ways. What does this injunction mean at this point?
Well, a preliminary injunction is an order that blocks, in this case, the Trump administration from moving forward with what it's trying to do. So this is a significant win for us. As you indicated, it's preliminary. This isn't the final ruling in the case. But what this means is that while the case plays out, unless there's either an appeal, which there likely will be, that leads to a different result, or until this case gets a final resolution, the Trump administration is blocked from effectively dismantling these three services. There are three of them here that are at issue. One is the Institute of Museum and Library Services, also the Minority Business Development Agency, and the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. And I want to highlight in this case some of what's going on with these reckless DOGE-inspired cuts, because you know the Institute of Museum and Library Services helps to fund libraries and museums in communities across the country. And libraries, of course, can be critical institutions in communities all over Wisconsin and all over the country. They provide kids with access to books, and they provide adults with access to books. But they're also critical community meeting spaces. And while that may not mean a lot if you're, you know, a billionaire like Elon Musk, it's important to communities across Wisconsin. And so slashing them to save a few dollars that can go towards a tax cut for some of the richest people in the country, while that may seem like a good idea to Elon Musk, it's leaving communities behind. And that's a theme that we're seeing throughout these attacks on our government from the Trump administration. So that's part of the reason we've taken action here. And so far, we've received this favorable ruling on the preliminary injunction. And again, I'm hopeful that we will be successful in this case, because these are agencies that were created by Congress, and the president can't unilaterally dismantle them.
We're talking about Wisconsin's involvement in several lawsuits against actions taken by President Trump and his administration. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is with us. Attorney General Call, a cynical observer might say, oh, Democratic Attorney General challenging a Republican president. This is just politics as usual. Can you make the case that there's something deeper involved here, something more at stake?
Well, there are a couple things I would point to. So first, what we are seeing from the Trump administration really is unprecedented. You know, we've talked about a few of the cases where the president is just ignoring the law, but that's happening on a widespread scale. You know, we've got a case involving his effort to undermine birthright citizenship, for example. And birthright citizenship is written into the U.S. Constitution. There's U.S. Supreme Court precedent. There's federal law that provides precedent. And the Trump administration isn't trying to hide the fact that they're ignoring the law. They're open about how they are stopping the funds of congressionally appropriated, or stopping the distribution of congressionally appropriated funds. They have suggested, or at least senior members of the administration have suggested that they can flout court orders. So we are seeing a pretty widespread attack on our very system of government, on the Constitution, and on the rule of law. And I don't think there's really any doubt about what's going on from the Trump administration here. The question for all of us is, how are we going to respond to this? How are AGs, how is Congress, how are citizens in our country responding to this? And my view is that our constitutional system and the rule of law are fundamentally important, and we need to do what we can to protect them. So we've been stepping up and taking action. And the results we're getting, I think, speak for themselves. You know, one of the cases that we're involved in was this widespread effort to freeze federal funding, which would have caused catastrophic events to all sorts of critical programs. And in that case, you know, we got a preliminary injunction blocking the administration from going forward. In another case, there was an effort to block funds that had been appropriated for research into cancer and other dangerous diseases through the NIH. And we got an order there blocking the administration as well. In fact, in that case, the administration agreed to a permanent injunction. So we've been successful in court, because these are sound legal challenges. And it's a high standard to get these preliminary orders blocking somebody from going forward. And yet we've gotten some critical rulings, and I'm hopeful we will get several more as these cases move forward.
We've seen instances where after a federal judge rules against the Trump administration, Republican members of Congress have called for impeachment or funding cuts to the particular courts they're in. Just talk so far, no serious action taken that I've seen. But are you concerned about that response and that threat to judges who don't rule in the review of those members of Congress in the right way?
Absolutely. This is fundamental to our system of government. We've got three co-equal branches of government. The executive branch led by the president is one of them, but the judiciary is a second co-equal branch, and they have a vitally important role to play in ensuring that the Constitution and laws are upheld. And it's important to note here that the judges who have been ruling against the Trump administration, some have been appointed by Democratic presidents, but some have been appointed by Republican presidents, even some appointed by Donald Trump himself. And so this is happening with judges appointed by both political parties. And Congress's response so far has been incredibly disappointing. It's often Congress's authority that the president is infringing on here. These are laws in some cases that Congress passed. And Donald Trump is ignoring those laws. It's critical that branch of government step up and stand up for the rule of law, including the separation of powers, rather than trying to further this effort by attacking a co-equal branch. You know, and when the founders of this country created our system of government, they created these co-equal branches to preserve our liberty and to protect it. And some of the most eloquent decisions on these issues come from conservative judges and justices. And so to see Republicans in Congress abandoning that idea to line up behind Donald Trump is disappointing. And I hope we will see a change in approaches as we move forward.
Attorney General Call, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Josh Call, Attorney General of Wisconsin, joining us for a look at Wisconsin's most recent lawsuits challenging Trump administration actions.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Wisconsinites in the fashion industry explain how the trade war will affect their clothing lines.
Maybe inspire people to think a little harder about the clothing that they buy, because some of the what was formerly very cheap clothing is going to become more expensive.
The view from the brand Fair Indigo. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kedar Tierkent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you want a sense of just how much clothing the U.S. imports, look no further than the shirt on your back.
China and Vietnam shipped about $31 billion of apparel to the U.S. in 2023.
With new tariffs and a trade war, we're learning more about how garments are made.
Iris Acevedo is an adjunct instructor in the fashion design departments of Mount Mary University and Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. She owns Reworked by Iris. Iris, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me, Kate. I am really looking forward to this conversation.
What are the processes that go into making a garment that we simply don't see when we pull that shirt or that pair of jeans out of our closet? Can you give us a quick tour of what's involved?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So when you pull that shirt out of your closet, what you don't see, first of all, is what was the innovation behind making of that shirt. The designer who was thinking about the person who was going to wear it, how it would fit, how it would feel on the body is part of the process, as well as like how will it look, the design aspect of it. So that's the first and foremost thing that people don't realize how much work goes into that thought process. And then what kind of fabric are you going to use to make that shirt? Where was that fabric made? How was it made? If it was cotton, where was it grown? The buttons, all of the things that go inside of the making of that shirt. And then the people who made your shirt and how much it cost and how much time it took for that person to make your shirt. And then that's just the beginning process. The other aspect of it is once it's done, like what markets is it going to go to? Who's going to distribute it? What stores are going to take it?
You have a sewing and design company in Milwaukee that you launched about 5 years ago. What led you to become an entrepreneur in fashion?
Honestly, I started learning. It's my second career. My first career was in academic advising, and I learned how to sew at the age of 30 after I had my first child. And I really fell in love with the process. And at the time, I was married and I moved to the East Coast and ended up being a house mom after I had my second child. And I needed to bring in income. So I started sewing to make extra cash. And then when me and my ex split, I felt like it was a clean slate. It's time to start over, and I wanted to do it in a way that allowed me to be in my kids' life as well as do something that I really enjoyed doing. So that's how Sew House Apparel was born. That's the original name of my business. I've re recently rebranded, and I can talk about that in a minute. But I've been able to provide alteration services and custom services to local clients in the city of Milwaukee and the surrounding area for the last 5 years. So it's been very rewarding.
Also, under your umbrella is sewing classes, I understand. Is there a growing maker's market of people who want to sew their own clothes? What are you experiencing?
Yeah, so there is a very large growing market of people who are learning how to sew again, which is really exciting. Most of that market, you do have local communities who are learning how to sew, as well as a very large online presence between online sewing schools or like sewing courses that people can purchase. YouTube is a huge resource for sewers. And then also the university is, we're seeing a growing number of students coming in who may have started off learning from YouTube. They're like, I think I want to do this.
When you look at the economics of this industry at the moment, we're seeing American imports billions of dollars in apparel and clothing materials every year. China and Vietnam are, on our labels, are the top two contributing countries. And consumer price increases are going to be double-digit estimates for clothing, in the short term. Are tariffs concerning to you in your line of work?
Yes, so tariffs are concerning. What I've been seeing, because I try to keep an eye on the trends with what's happening, there are a lot of brands, especially small brands, who may have niched their brand by using something like Japanese denim, or they do their manufacturing overseas, and so the idea of having to deal with tariffs is concerning to them in terms of how they're going to be able to continue to produce what they're producing at a price that people can afford. And so that is something that I'm seeing. The other thing that I'm seeing is I know like we do a lot with China. And so people like producers of cotton in our country who like export cotton to China for manufacturing. I know there are some farmers who are concerned about that as well. That's what I've kind of been seeing.
Oh, so, we're exporting that raw cotton to China. It is going through processes to get ready to be made into things like jeans.
Yeah, we are the number one consumer of denim, but we're not even in like the top 10 of manufacturers of denim.
So, in terms of the materials that you use and that you teach in your coursework, are there certain apparel materials or textiles that are more sustainable that we should think about?
Oh, yes, sustainability is huge. I teach textiles. That's like the number one class that I really teach. And I've shifted in the classroom to really focusing on natural fibers. There is a trend again towards moving away from the synthetics. So things like cotton, things like linen, the more traditional fibers that we're used to seeing. But also there's a lot of innovation with alternative, what are called alternative plant fibers. So things like hemp are something that people are doing a lot of research around to see how that we can incorporate them into the textile industry for, the making of clothes and different things. And then other things that are interesting, like milk fiber. People don't realize that you can actually make fabric out of milk.
What?
It's really fun. I have a lot of group projects with my students. And when we get to those kind of interesting fibers that you never think about, what could make fabric from, they get really excited and geeked out. And they come up with some cool stuff, some cool ideas.
Wow. this ability to produce, though, inexpensive, low quality clothing, like that fast fashion, those $5 t-shirts, would the US be able to open those types of factories? What do you think?
I think some people would arguably say that we have had some of those factories within our borders. You know, the garment district in LA has been reported over, you know, over the years, different times, not properly reporting their labor force. But I believe right now would be a really great time for us to think about how we can produce domestically and in a way that builds the economy for everyone, not just the person who wants to spend $30 on a pair of jeans. I think that we've put enough pressure on the fashion industry, we meaning, you know, people, consumers, the industry as a whole, people who are interested in sustainability and seeing things change, have put enough pressure where I think with everything that's going on with the tariffs, it's a great time to think about how can we reopen ourselves up to producing our own things and not just consuming.
When you say we've put pressure on, do you mean pressure in terms of trying to get things at cheaper, or do you mean pressure to source those clothes more sustainably and for all the steps that go into that process?
Source sustainably. I think there's a growing movement towards, number one, for sure, the secondhand market has increased because of that. There's a lot of people who are really into thrifting as a way of practicing a sustainable lifestyle. But also there are a growing number of independent designers who have created a nice little niche industry for themselves, being, you know, more sustainable in their design practice. So you may get a high quality pair of jeans made from a small designer who may only produce 25 pairs of jeans in a line, right? But it has a quality fabric. It's well made. It's designed to last. So there are people who have been slowly but surely, we don't see them yet on the grand scale. Even Levi's for a while has, you know, they came out with a couple of sustainable fibers, whether it's like recycled cotton. They did have a line a couple years ago with hemp. Hemp can be what's called cottonized. So it can be processed in a way where it's soft and produced in a way that you can use the same to create cotton, like cotton fabric from the cotton plant. So it looks just like denim, but instead of cotton, it's hemp.
On the scale that you, Iris, is at, what have you learned by running your own label, by running your own brand?
It's a lot of work, and you have to have a lot of passion and dedication to what you're doing. Because at the beginning, a lot of times you're on your own. You know, you have to be able to think about what can I do just me until you can get to that place where you can scale and open the door for opportunity for others. So that's like the biggest thing is you got to really have a clear focus and a passion and a dedication. I'm going for the long haul. I'm not going for quick gains. You know, I recognize this is a marathon and not a sprint.
Iris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Iris Acevedo, who owns a sewing and apparel business in Milwaukee. We're hearing the perspective of Wisconsinites in the fashion industry amid trade war concerns. Joining us now is Robert Benke, president and founder of the Madison-based clothing brand Fair Indigo. Mariana Otoya is here. She and her brother run their family's apparel business. It's based in Lima, Peru. Mariana, let's learn more about your family apparel business. And I understand it was founded by your parents. How did this idea to make apparel come together?
It was a business that my parents started a little bit more of 48 years ago.
Wow.
It started a few years before that when my mother, she worked at the production ministry here in Peru. And she worked many projects with different groups of artisans and a lot of handwork. And that's how they decided to get these products and get it to a standard quality that it could be exported to different parts of the world. It was kind of an adventure at that time.
Robert, pick it up from here and the role you had in Fair Indigo in the story.
At the time we met Mariana and her family, it was 2012, and we had been in business about 6 years. It had its ups and downs, and we were sort of still finding our way in terms of what kind of products we could make and what kind of products our customers would love. And, you know, we founded Fair Indigo as a fair trade apparel brand. So we were focusing on finding facilities that paid workers a living wage and treated them, you know, with respect. We were working in Peru with some other suppliers, and the agent that we were working in down there, he arranged all our meetings for us. And on the last day, he said, "Oh, there's one more place I want to stop at." And we said, "No, Sergio, we don't have time. We have our flights, you know, at nine o'clock. It was myself and my designer at the time, and 45 seconds and our jaws just dropped. At the time, they were doing handiwork for kids' dolls, but really amazing, amazing detail and quality. And I wasn't an expert in that area, but my designer was. And she said, "Robert, this is, we don't find this kind of work anywhere. This is amazing, amazing work." We met Elsa and Javier, who are Mariana's parents, that day. Within 10 minutes of knowing them, we felt like, you know, we have to do our audits. We have to do all the things we do to certify that businesses are indeed fair trade and paying living wages, et cetera. But in our gut, we knew like this was going to be a great place.
Fast forward, if you would, to the world business climate as you see it now and the White House tariffs. Mm-hmm. What comes up for you? What concerns do you have?
You know, for us, there is a new tariff. Peru and the United States have had a mutual free trade agreement for several years. So we pay 0% tariffs on each other's products. Now we are paying 10% on our product that comes from Peru. Is it fun? No. Is it, do we feel it? Yes. We are fortunate enough that it's only 10%, and we can sort of try to work around that as best we can. And one silver lining here, this will maybe inspire people to think a little harder about the clothing that they buy, because some of the what was formerly very cheap clothing is going to become more expensive.
Mariana, thinking about how apparel factories can operate in other countries of the world under very harsh working conditions, it seems like that is not the case inside your company. How do you make that so?
I think it has a lot to do with how the business started. It's a family-owned business, and we started from a family relationship with everybody that we work with. Mm-hmm. We have very long relationships with our employers. I mean, like, we know their families, and we're also very close to the workshops that we work with the farmers. I have two kids, a 15-year-old and 12-year-old. And for example, on Saturday, we want to visit the cotton farms, and we go as a family, and I take them and they meet the farmers, and, you know, like, we just share everything.
Robert, learning about this system that Mariana is describing, and when I think about the clothes on me that the tags say made in China or made in Vietnam, what would it take to replicate this type of production system and open a garment factory doing what Mariana is doing, but doing it here in Wisconsin?
Very challenging on the cotton part, because we can't grow cotton in Wisconsin, but we could get cotton from South Carolina, for example. But we haven't made a lot of apparel in the United States for a very, very long time. One of the main reasons is because, to be quite honest, it's hard work that not a lot of people would want to do for 8 hours a day. Where we work in Peru, the apparel production is sort of where it was here many, many decades ago, where it was an aspirational job. You know, the wages are much higher in the United States than they are in developing countries. So I think part of the reason that there isn't a lot of production in the United States anymore is because the clothing would be quite a bit more expensive to make it here. I think there's definitely a growing movement for doing things in a sort of small batches. So I know that some technical and trade schools are reintroducing sort of the old school apparel making skills that was happening before the tariff situation. But I think this will probably, you know, supercharge that a little bit. I don't think it will ever be mass production here in the United States, as far as I can imagine.
And Mariana, from the cotton field to sending the samples that have been put together to specification sent to Madison, how long is that process typically?
When we get the samples, we we start with the fabric, cotton plants. Mm-hmm. We gather all the cotton once a year, and then we do the fabric. We knit the fabrics. And then the sampling process, it's depending on the brand. Some brands do 2 seasons, some do 4, some do a little, you know, like a holiday season in between for the sample to be approved, like around 1 month, probably. And then there's the timing for the fabric to knit the whole fabric for the production and to dye the fabric with requested colors. That takes a little longer, like 40, 45 days.
Okay, Robert, hot take. What is the most coveted piece of clothing in your closet?
I better not say it's my Fair Indigo t-shirt. That'll sound like a sell job. So I'm going to say it's my dad's flannel shirt that I inherited from him after he passed away. I think it was made in the 70s. It's something I don't wear very often, but it is something that I always see in the corner of my closet, and I really love it.
Oh, that you cherish. Mariana, how about you?
I think I'm going to go with one of our t-shirts. It's just like some of the t-shirts I have for maybe 10, 12 years. Pima is a very special type of fabric that you get out of Pima, that you're not going to get it from any other kind of seed that you plant.
Well, Mariana and Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been great to talk with you.
Thanks.
That is Robert Benke, co-founder and president of Fair Indigo, a Madison-based clothing brand, and Mariana Otoya. She and her brother run their family's apparel business in Peru. And earlier, we spoke with Milwaukee's Iris Acevedo, owner of a sewing and design company.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Milwaukee gospel group has an unwavering faith, and these women have hit the high notes for decades.
It's a ministry. It's a song in you, and every song has a story. So in singing, we're telling a story and encouraging and uplifting someone that may be going through something.
Meet OW's Exalters. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Mother's Day, some parents get to rest. Their families might take them to brunch or serve them coffee in bed.
But one group of women will be leading congregations in song and bringing people to their feet in praise.
Listen, friend.
That is OW's Exalters, a soul gospel group that performs around Wisconsin. Tiffany Boyd is one of the 6 vocalists. And about Mother's Day.
Mothers never get breaks. There's never a break for a mother.
On Sunday, the group will perform in Milwaukee for a Mother's Day musical.
And for a preview, producer Mackenzie Crummy and I visited the OW's Exalters at Holy Temple Firstborn Missionary Baptist Church in Milwaukee's Lincoln Park neighborhood on a recent Sunday.
Can we collaborate on the beat? Let's do Jesus, and we'll try to do real fast.
And all of y'all sing.
Jesus.
First things first, this gospel troupe has a deep relationship with God.
Jesus, you know we don't have but one life to live. Yeah,
Lord, I live with Jesus.
So brilliant. Oh, my goodness.
They show it when they are in perfect harmony at the altar of Baptist churches. They show it after a performance decked out in matching baby blue dresses sitting around a table in the church basement as we are now. Also, most of them are related.
I'm Mary Griffin. I am the overseer. I do lead, tenor, and tone. And I'm the mother of, I'm the biological mother of 1, 2, 3. And all of these are my adopted girls right here. 1, 2, 3. These are my children from another mother.
So I'm Tiffany Boy. I'm the booking manager, and I'm the top and the tenor singer and lead singer.
I am Patrice Carter. I am the manager of OW's Exalters.
I am Kaya Evans.
I am Amber Wilkerson, and I'm Temple Smith.
I am Travoris Griffin.
I am Terrence Griffin. I am the bass player and overseer of the music director of the band.
Deacon O.W. Griffin started this gospel group in the family's basement. As the story goes, Griffin and the boys would sing together and the girls would run downstairs to harmonize. Deacon Griffin died in 2008, but the Exalters added O.W. to their name in his honor, and the group is celebrating 35 years together.
Hello, 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 hello. Yep.
That sounds good.
Okay, yep. That sounds good. All
okay,
right.
Okay, why don't we start with Tiffany? Can you distinguish what is soul gospel to you and the Exalters?
Well, it's an uplifting, it's a ministry, and that's what we do. We carry it. It's a song in you, and every song has a story. So in singing, we're telling a story and encouraging and uplifting someone that may be going through something.
How much inspiration do you get from people who are listening to you in the congregation or sitting in the service? What radiates?
Well, it depends. They lift their hands, they clap, they praise, they participate. If they're going through, they minister to themselves, witness to themselves, and that such thing. Hallelujah.
Gospel groups in Milwaukee share a strong bond with one another, even though they attend different churches.
It's me.
At this service, OW's Exalters are performing in honor of another gospel troupe.
They're praying.
Down a hallway of the church, a group of women put on rhinestone-studded outfits and come together for a prayer. It is there I meet Sister Glenda Jeans of Milwaukee's legendary Holy Gospel Singers, a group that is celebrating 45 years.
Am I looking all right?
You look smashing. You look amazing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Who in your life kind of brought you along with music? Where did you learn to sing?
Okay, I'm from Mississippi. I was in the field. I got to tell it. And hoeing cotton, you might not know about that, in hot sun. And he spoke to me, and I looked up and showed me that he wanted me to sing with the group. I didn't know anything about singing, quartet group, singing. So that went away. I was only 14. Then my mother passed, and I moved to Milwaukee. I got married. I was 20-something, I guess. I don't know. But then he came to me again one Sunday morning about he want this group to sing. And he showed me everybody in a bubble, individually, to sing. So I went to each one of them, told them. They said, let's do it.
Sister Glenda Jeans and the OW's Exalters have been friends for years, and they support each other and lift up one another's work. Here's Tiffany again.
We fellowship a lot. It's like different groups, and every weekend it's like someone else's anniversary. So all of the groups end up going to each other group's anniversaries and celebrating with them and fellowshipping with them. So we're all like one big family. We all know each other.
So
yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, we commune together as we serve one God. So, yes.
OW's Exalters practice and perform regularly. Each Wednesday is rehearsal, and since they were young, they've stayed committed to the group and committed to producing original material. That was a standard set by the father of the group, Deacon O.W. Griffin, who forbade them to sing anyone else's works. Here's Tiffany with her mother, Mary Griffin.
Let her know that Daddy didn't allow us to sing anything.
Right. Never. He said never. No, we sing our own songs, because if we get on the floor singing someone else's song, someone else may get up to sing our song before we sing our song. Then what do you do? So all our songs are original.
That takes a lot of work.
A lot of work.
To put together original compositions for everything you do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember one time we were in Chicago and we were just standing outside of a pastor's church and we just started singing. We have a song called Sunshine. There Won't Always Be Sunshine. And we've written that song standing outside.
Granddaughter-in-law Micaiah Evans often writes the lyrics whenever inspiration comes to her.
For me, the songs that I've written recently, I wrote basically during pain or different low moments. That's how I found myself getting out of it, writing music. Sometimes I also dream about it, so I'm like, oh, let me throw that in there because it'll be real nice. And what makes it better for me is that my boyfriend currently is the MD. So a lot of times it's like 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm like, oh, I just got this song. And we get up and we just write, record it, and then go back to sleep. So, yeah, you know, just going through life and, you know, don't want to let yourself get down. So you find something to do, write your music, and it's always going to be a hit.
How does writing music make you feel?
It is a release for me because a lot of times I can't articulate exactly what I want to say or something like that. But if I do write a song, perfectly, it speaks for me. So, yeah.
OW's Exalters are working on their fifth album. They perform most Sundays and often fit in dozens of performance dates a month. These women are also known for hitting the high notes in a bright, clear tone. Here's manager Patrice Carter.
But to hit those high notes is all God. To be perfectly honest with you, it's by God's grace. It's not my doing at all. It's all Him. I can't tell you. It's just His gift that He has given us. And I'm piggyback on to Dad. He was a man of integrity. He was very structured. I believe, as being the manager for the last several years now, that looking back, when we used to be in rehearsal, Dad used to try to give us something and they couldn't get it. And he'll say, Patrice, you get it. You do it. And I'll do it and I give it to them and then they'll get it. And I just feel now that all that time that he was grooming me, didn't know it, but I feel like he was grooming me to be in the position that I am now. So,
which is to help people feel closer to God.
Y'all, get ready, get ready. Listen, the spirit is high. We're going to keep it moving just like this here. That's all I'm talking about. When you come to church, you want to ought to have church, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Amen, amen. And so our next group, listen, that's going to minister to us. I'm not going to say sing, but they're going to minister because that's exactly what they do. And that is none other than OWZ Exalters. You all come on, clap your hands, give them some praise. Come on. Come on, come on. Shout hallelujah. Shout thank you, Jesus.
As Mary Griffin gets older, she thinks about the legacy of her family and the OW's Exalters' place in the community. After decades of marriage, Mary remembers how the group performed at Deacon O.W. Griffin's funeral, which was difficult on Mary.
It was a real challenge. At one point, me personally, I just didn't feel like I could carry it on. I could do it justice. And I did want to give up, but through encouragement, and me realizing how being in the church had kept my kids from things that, you know, could have gone really bad or they just not cared about life. But it was the singing that they loved to do that held them.
For now, Mary keeps close watch of the next generation of OW's Exalters and what roles her great-grandchildren will have in singing and in the band that backs up the women.
And then I watch my little kids over here, this little girl right here. This is my great-granddaughter. That's Mackenzie.
Hi, sweetie. Can you say your name?
What's your name? Mackenzie Griffin.
There's a Mackenzie and there's a Mackenzie.
My name's Mackenzie too.
Oh my gosh.
Her name Mackenzie too, Kenzie.
Wait, how old are you? 3?
Wow. Awesome.
Look at you.
And right now, she wants to sing. That's the fourth generation. So I'm excited. It just keeps going and going. And I believe that at the end, his legacy is going to live on for a long time. A long time.
My name is Camden. 7.
What do the OW's Exalters mean to you?
It means to me is love and kindness.
Love and kindness. Why do you feel that when you think of them?
Because they always make so many good of the good.
They see the sunshine.
Yeah.
Do you want to see that as well when you are a little bit bigger? Would you like to be part of that experience?
Yes, in the band.
In the band? What do you want to do in the band?
Just play drum.
Is that a good way to praise and to really be a part of your community and to really love Jesus?
Yes. And it means so much to God because I love God so much.
Camden, just like all the mothers who surround him, keep the faith and sing. That story was produced by Mackenzie Crummy with sound design by Sarah Hopeful. OW's Exalters perform Sunday at True Love Missionary Baptist Church in Milwaukee with a Mother's Day musical. To see other performances, you can visit their Facebook page or attend a service at a number of Milwaukee's Baptist churches. They just might be there. And they take us out here on music they performed at Holy Temple Firstborn Missionary Baptist Church on a recent Sunday. This song is He Saved Me.
His grace, love and mercy, through God I am free. He looks at my shackles, I am free. He saved me.
I'm a big fan of games, board games, and card games in particular, so I'm excited about a conversation coming up tomorrow on the show. The owner of a board game store in Sheboygan makes the case that games are fun and good for us because of the social connection they can provide, plus some mental health benefits.
And we want to hear from you. If you are a fan of games, do you value them for the social side of things? Do you have a group of friends or family members who bond over games? Do you see games as therapeutic in some way?
Tell us about it right now. Email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Courtney Everett, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.